Blog Talk Radio.
Freshmen, and they were the inspiration for the Beach Boys. They liked that Four Freshmen style. They tried to duplicate it and then modified their own style. The big news tonight is everybody is pointing fingers at everybody over this massacre, and I hate to call it a massacre, but that's what it is, out in Arizona, out in Tucson. And I watched this sheriff come out and try and blame talk show hosts for the massacre. And I quickly got off something to Rush Limbaugh this morning and said, the sheriff is a moot jerk and a political stooge, and he is. He's a mouthpiece for the party of death. He failed to protect the people of Arizona from a pothead leftist, the devil worshiper slash demoncrat. At a political gathering of 100 people, there should have been at least one law enforcement officer present. It took three citizens to do the police job. Get a new sheriff or go for retraining with a real Arizona sheriff, and don't forget to bring your pink panties. And that's all I'm saying about that. Now I will get serious. If you can call a spade, you can call a liberal a communist. For the first couple of days, they showed this guy his little boy Blue, you know, with a big smile on his face and a nice clean T-shirt. And then finally, when we got to see him at his arraignment, he looked like the guy that torched that Connecticut family. If from now on, when any liberal offends me in politics, I'm putting this guy's picture next to his and say, Jekyll and Hyde, they're both the same. My guess is that the communists outnumber the patriots 60 to 40. And that's a bad sign because it used to be 51 and we were outnumbered 40. We were 49. But with the election of Chairman Obama, supported by the Communist Party, it allowed the silent Leninists to get brazen and expose themselves. Two great indicators of their takedown America intention was to vote to kill kids, many of them black, under the false impression it was a woman's choice. The Constitution says all Americans are entitled to a trial by a jury of their peers, and that includes the unborn. An American is created by God at jackpot time when the sperm breaches the egg, and that is three Liberty Bells straight across. The most obvious self-identification as a communist was when 48 senators and 135 Viet Congress mice voted to burn the American flag 40 days before 9/11. And here, the communists, as they distort everything, called it freedom of speech. Then they voted no anesthesia for partial birth abortions because they would have to admit that American babies, as they're being pulled apart, feel pain. So they voted no anesthesia. I wonder how much anesthesia they're going to ask at the end of the trial, at the end of the trail. Huh? You think they're going to vote no anesthesia for themselves? You're going to think they're going to say, I don't want to live any longer because I got to make room for a murderer who's going to get life in prison, and I got to cover his food costs? They plan to fully seize the half-seized government already. They imprison Americans who demand that the president show proof of citizenship. The Marxist president who denounced his own country. You can't get into a high school without your grammar school records, but if somebody asks you to see the president's homework, they're labeled the Tea Party racist. Never forget the communists say, never let a good crisis go to waste. Blame and deflect are Marxist tactics. Labeling also is a Marxist tool. They control the entire media, from the New York Slimes to the Stars and Stripes military news. And that's the truth. Get a copy and read it and weep. Now, no one in their right minds trusts NBC, CBS, CNN, Newsweek, WEAK, and Slime Magazine. You know, you can't even get a stamp showing 9/11. The last time freedom was on a stamp was Pearl Harbor. Religion is the opiate of the masses, and you won't find a communist at mass unless it is to exploit their cause, like Hanoi John Kerry getting ashes from the church boiler room, or Uday Pelosi saying she is a practicing Catholic who misses practice all the time. In order to fly to Syria and lick the ankles of comrade Bashar al-Assad, Uday will go, while IEDs made in Iran, finished in Damascus, blow the faces, legs, and arms off of American troops. And if you think nine dead Americans in Tucson, Arizona is a tragedy, you should go to Arlington Cemetery. While Comrade Harry Reid says the war is lost, and Comrade Barney Frank forces banks to make failing loans under the penalty of purge and label that bank racist, followed by a visit of the party bagman, Comrade Jesse, to pick up some champagne contributions, then on to Wall Street for President Pinocchio Pants, the draft dodger and groper who made $137 million in government service on the books, plus a monthly pension of $84,000 on the books, not counting what his wife tells her brother to give back to the Vignali drug lords. $50,000 short. Yeah. Oh, that's not in the media. You won't find that. You know, that disappeared as quick as the look on Bill Clinton's face when he was told that the buildings were collapsing on 9/11 and he was in Australia. You will never see that photograph. You can Google all you want, but the look was guilty. While Comrade Nancy fakes a Selma march carrying the sacred gavel to set up a communist stunt where innocent Tea Party goers are labeled racist with no proof of anybody saying the N-word, and the only N-word that was shouted was "Go home, Nancy," but there she was in her Rosa Parks costume playing a full deck of race cards. So the communist media controls the minds of the people, satisfying Articles 18, 20, 21, 23, and 24 of the 45 communist objectives to take over America. The only thing that stops them is the internet and talk radio, and both are targets for a takedown and communist control. Today, a communist in the House has suggested the censorship of inflammatory words like freedom, give me liberty or give me death, and my country right or wrong. And let me add my favorite praise, my favorite phrase, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. The Leninist takeover did not start yesterday. It goes back to traitors like the Rosenbergs who gave Stalin the American plans for the atomic bomb. In a salute to Joe Stalin, the current president has wiped out Star Wars defense, NASA, and given back recently freed satellite slave nations to Rasputin, his master. This year's gift to the new improved Soviet Union is Poland, Czechoslovakia, Ukraine, and Georgia. Surely Georgia was not on his mind when he danced the Kazatsky with Vlad the Plutonium Impaler. The first two-year putsch was a given as we lambs waited to see the wolf's direction. Now comes phase two, and don't think he's not planning to have his own SS. He will, like a Nazi socialist, have the Night of the Long Knives, where he strips the Praetorian Guard, the U.S. Marine Corps, of all fight-back power, and substitutes weak party admirals, generals, and secretaries of no defense. Remember when Clinton had Poem Cohn as Secretary of Defense? He was an inside party joke. He was a re-puppy stooge on the same level as Hanoi John Kerry, who nearly became president, God forbid. One consolation prize is Obama is better than Al Sharpton, another Democrat golden boy who could have beaten Kerry. Google the 45 declared goals of the Communist Party and see how many objectives these communists have already achieved. Keep a barf bag handy because you will be sick. My guess is since 1963, they have reached 40 out of the 45 goals. Therefore, I say, you lost your country and you're never getting it back. The spoils of this nation have been divided amongst three communist groups. Our military defense has been given to the Russians. Our mental health has been given to the drug lords and paid for by us. Our industry has been given to the Chinese. All that is left is government revenue from taxes, porn, and gambling. If you paid into Social Security for 50 years and asked to see your cut in Al Gore's lockbox, they will tell you that it is sealed with Obama's graduation yearbook, along with Governor Dean's mental health score. America is more divided now than in the Civil War, and we have no leaders. The motto, God and country forever, is replaced with, what's in it for me? We cannot wait for a termite to fulfill a bad term. We must turn to impeachment, be it a judge, a president, or a police chief in Tucson. Impeachment will get everybody's attention, and if the liberals smell it coming, they will campaign all day long to stop the trend. Did you see Janet Napoleono getting off Air Force 3 after looking for illegal Mexicans in Israel? She promised that no wetback would ever cross the Jordash River. How many shopping bags was she carrying? I counted three. Get closer to God. When Paul Revere rides into your town shouting to arms, pray the response is not, we can't, we can't. And tonight, after the next tune, we're going to read Chapter 3, Red Cocaine, the communist plot to drug the entire world. You don't believe that, right? You think the joint you're buying was grown in Happy Land. Bartender, champagne. So the last couple of nights we've been covering a book entitled Red Cocaine. And chapter one sort of describes how the Chinese communists under Mao Zedong back in 1928 started growing opium to raise money and to corrupt the West. And that was chapter one. And in chapter two, the Soviets, unknown to the Chinese, decided to get into the game. And they wouldn't tell the Chinese what they were doing because the Chinese were concentrating in the Asian area. So the Soviets concentrated on the Middle East and they concentrated on Europe. And they started to develop networks of for drug distribution, cocaine being one of them. And it also tells you in the book that in the war in Korea, both South Koreans and American troops that had been captured were taken, some were taken to a hospital in North Korea under the guise of treating them, and they would use them for drug experimentation. We never heard about that. We didn't know about it. And there were people coming from other communist countries to observe and to experiment also. Okay? So now we're up to Chapter 3, which is now they're turning to Latin America to develop a drug market. And so that's where we're at, and that's what I'm going to start with. So hang in there. The main objective of the infiltration was to obtain information on individuals who had been corrupted by drug and narcotics trafficking. Key target groups that were identified were the military, police, government, politics, religions, and business. Additional targets were scientific institutions, military industry, and universities. A secondary objective was to obtain intelligence on all drug and narcotics production and distribution activity to enable the Soviets to exert a strategic control and help prevent the various independent operations from interfering with one another. Intelligence derived from organized crime penetrations also contributed to this objective. The first meeting to coordinate the infiltration and collection of data on drug and narcotics corruption that Sejina is the high Czechoslovak military official that blew the whistle, that came over to the West. So the Sejina was aware of occurred in 1962 during the Second Havana Conference at a secret meeting of Soviet and Soviet-trained strategic intelligence agents from all the Latin American organizations. The secret meeting was managed by Cuban and Czechoslovak intelligence. Czechoslovak officials from military intelligence, Z, organized the meeting. Other Czechoslovak officials attended the conference were from the Ministry of Interior, Second Administration, the KGB intelligence counterpart in Czechoslovakia. And poor Czechs must have taken a terrible beating. And military counterintelligence, the people I'm talking about. In collecting data on individuals corrupted by drug trafficking, both those using drugs or profiting from the trafficking, the Soviets identified large numbers of people who could be bribed, who were susceptible to influence. Today they call them lobbyists. And most important, as Sejina elaborated, who were not concerned about the consequences of their actions, like the liberal in Tucson today, this week. The resulting information in the dossiers provided an excellent base for recruiting agents of influence or spies. This information was also used to expose and damage the reputations of individuals and organizations considered hostile to Soviet interests. That's what you have today. They had to move on the Tea Party by the Communist Party of North America, formerly the Democrats. So the use of corruption data for blackmail and for recruiting agents of influence is a longstanding Marxist-Leninist tactic, which is used on a global scale. You can also label a guy a racist, a homophobe, an anti-Semite. That's another way of taking down people with fight-back capability. Czechoslovak intelligence divided its dossiers on corruption into two categories: people already in positions of power, you hear this, and people at lower levels who were likely to advance into positions of power. Yes, from Chicago. By 1967, Czechoslovak intelligence had about 2,500 dossiers on people in the first category. Their files did not duplicate the dossiers maintained by others who were active in Latin America, the Cubans, East Germans, Hungarians, Bulgarians, and Soviets. Do you know what it's like to live in a country where everybody betrays everybody? Huh? Where it's every man for himself? And you can't trust anybody because trust has been destroyed. Because of cooperation among the intelligence services, thus by the late 60s, the Soviets already possessed corruption data on upwards of 10,000 influential people throughout Latin America. As an indication that these numbers are not unreasonable, in 1971, a Frenchman by the name of Batkun was caught bringing heroin into Canada. He was deported to France and convicted there of exporting heroin. During the trial, Batkun was identified as a member of the French Communist Party and an agent of the subsection Groupement Cinq of the Soviet KGB. During his trial, Valeurs Actuelles reported that when arrested, he had in his possession, wait till you hear this, Valeurs Actuelles must be a newspaper, that he had in his possession a list of 2,000 heroin addicts in Canada, many of whom were prominent civil servants, artists, radio and television entertainers, and university professors. How sophisticated are they today from what they accomplished in 1971? Well, you think they're gone? You don't think the KGB is now the Russian mafia? Totally infiltrated in the United States. Corruption, of course, is not confined to Latin America, but includes North America and European countries such as France, Sweden, Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Great Britain, and Germany, of which the last two were identified by the head of the CPSU International Development Department, Boris Ponomarev, as the most corrupt, the last two. Great Britain and Germany, marked as the most corrupt. Recognizing that the financial institutions that help launder illicit money are part of this network of corruption, the potential for Soviet blackmail and influence operations becomes mind-numbing. Indeed, as will be discussed later. Now, they're talking about 2,000 heroin addicts in Canada in 1971 that were on a Soviet contact list. Can you imagine how many of our own politicians are corrupt by all of the vices that are available to them? You wonder when a guy stands up and says he's for this, you wonder what's behind it, right? Knowledge of how various independent drug operations work, what their trafficking networks are, and who their contacts are, is also used in pursuit of the second objective mentioned on page 26, to exercise strategic control over the operations. In general, the Soviets do not want or need tactical day-to-day control. Now, if the Soviet Union is down, you don't think somebody picked this up when they were selling off companies to each other, the big boys? You don't think somebody picked up the drug operation? So long as drugs and narcotics and the network are flowing in the right direction into bourgeois societies, Soviet objectives are being accomplished. What is important to the Soviets is to prevent such activities from interfering with other Soviet bloc operations, and certainly to prevent such operations from causing the spotlight of publicity to be shone in the wrong, to be shown in the wrong direction. The information collected via this process was impressive. In 1963, General Sagina, the Ministry of Defense, and the Chief of Military Intelligence visited the seized drug trafficking center at Bratislava. Their host and escort was Colonel Karol Borski, the military intelligence political officer who was in charge of the training centers. At the time, Sagina was amazed at the scope of the detail on drug trafficking around the world, but especially throughout Latin America, that had been assembled at the Bratislava training location. For example, extensive data had been acquired on numerous companies in Mexico, the main business of which was drug smuggling, including pictures of the trucks and the names of the drivers used to transport the drugs into the United States. This is back in the 60s. Now you don't think it's bigger and better with the NAFTA highway? Armed with control of how drug operations work, the Soviets watch an operation and exert control only when necessary. The potential for strategic control is evident from testimony given in 1983 by Juan Crump, a Colombian lawyer and narcotics trafficker. In response to questions by Senator Dennis DeConcini, Democrat of Arizona, on the importance of contacts with the Colombian officials, Crump responded that contact bribery was essential in order to exist and survive. Through Soviet knowledge of these officials and intelligence on their illegal activities, the Soviets obtained the leverage to exert control over the independent drug operations when necessary. Another mechanism employed to deal with organizations or individuals who do not cooperate is to set them up for arrest by drug enforcement authorities. That has been rumored to be what enabled U.S. authorities to bring to trial the Colombian drug lord Carlos Lleida Rivas. Possible reasons for his betrayal are easy to imagine. For example, either the Soviets or the members of the Medellin cartel could have concluded that Lleida had become too vocal, too political. Lleida was given radio interviews and calling cocaine the Latin American atomic bomb. Cocaine was a revolutionary weapon to be used against the imperialists, he explained. The problem with what he was saying was that it focused unnecessary attention on the drug operations, especially on the Medellin cartel, of which he was a member and was close enough to the truth about the Soviet operation, that either party could have concluded that Lleida had to be silenced. The beauty of simply turning him over to American law enforcement authorities was that it improved the public image of these authorities, even though all they were really doing was acting as disciplinary agents for the drug trafficking organization. Remember, the name of this story is Red Cocaine, in this book. Another example of this practice was provided by Ramon Millan Rodriguez, a Miami-based CPA who managed a significant proportion of the drug money earned by Colombia's Medellin cartel. While in the process of taking $5.3 million in cash out of the United States in May 1983, he was arrested and subsequently convicted of racketeering. Rodriguez was employed by the cartel to set up safe houses for collecting, counting, and packaging the cash. Wouldn't you like to be able to package cash? He then arranged the shipment of the money, a complex laundering process, to various banks. And that's why the California communists want to legalize weed, because they want some of that action. So what's the difference between them and the drug dealers? All the banks in Panama were used by Rodriguez in the process. Eventually, he explained, most of the money returned to him, which he then invested in real estate, stocks, bonds, certificates of deposit for the cartel. When Rodriguez first set up the operation, here's a familiar name, Manuel Antonio Noriega was an army colonel in charge of Panama's intelligence service. Rodriguez testified before a U.S. subcommittee in 1988 that he believed Noriega had very adroitly used the American law enforcement agencies to surgically extract me from the operation while leaving the operation intact for him and his cronies to continue working. The tip-off for Rodriguez's arrest was an anonymous wire, presumably sent by Noriega from Panama to the South Florida Task Force on Drug Interdiction, alerting them to Rodriguez's plans. But there are other possibilities worth considering. Rodriguez states throughout his testimony that he was strongly anti-communist. In 1980 or 1981, Cuban intelligence, the DGI, had tried to recruit him into their operation, but he turned them down. At about the same time, a war started between the Medellin cartel and the Cuban-sponsored M19 revolutionaries. Rodriguez states that he advised the cartel on how to fight the war using terrorist tactics and then advised against cooperating with the M19 after the dispute was resolved. Rodriguez further explains how he cautioned the cartel about the measures he saw being taken by Cuban intelligence to penetrate and gain control of the cartel. Finally, Rodriguez explained how he was especially careful in his dealings with Noriega to ensure that Noriega was powerful enough to serve us, but never let him get powerful enough to control us. While the telex to Miami that triggered Rodriguez's arrest may have come from Noriega, under the circumstances, it would also be logical to suspect the Cuban or Soviet intelligence agent might have been behind it. Okay. Though the use of information gained by infiltrating the various drug organizations, the Soviets had no need for direct tactical control of all Latin American operations. Indeed, it is better that they maintain their distance and that even insiders should remain unaware of the leverage control the Soviets can exert when necessary. This operating principle can be seen reflected in the secret resolution adopted at the Tricontinental Congress held in Cuba in 1966, which stated as its sixth operating principle, hang in there, to back up resolutely the campaign of the drug addicts, defending it in the name of respect for individual rights. I'm going to read it again. To back up resolutely the campaign of the drug addicts, defending it in the name of respect for individual rights. To maintain completely apart the cadres of the Communist Party from the channels for narcotics and their traffic, so that this source of income could not be linked with the revolutionary action of the Communist Party. Although we must combine fostering the fear of atomic war with pacifism and with the demoralization of youth by means of hallucinating agents, emphasis added. Following the decision to have Cuban intelligence agents infiltrate all Latin American operations, the Soviet Defense Council gave further instructions again to the Czechoslovak Defense Council, this time for Cuba, to establish its own production and trafficking operations in various Latin American countries. This provided a first-level backup for the indigenous operations. Cuba now moved rapidly to establish narcotics activities in Mexico and Colombia. The resulting Cuban drug network set up in Colombia was manned by Colombians but directed by Cuba. Czechoslovak intelligence helped. I got to tell you something. I'm reading this and I'm asking myself this one question. How smart is our intelligence? Are we running like a football player running next to the receiver to intercept that ball at the final moment? I don't know. I don't think so. I think we're blind. As soon as the new arrangements were underway in Mexico and Colombia, the Cubans, with the assistance of the Czechs, expanded into Panama and Argentina, and with the assistance of East Germany, into Uruguay and Jamaica. Cuba and Czechoslovakia also developed a joint operations in Chile. This book should be reading material for every decent government official in any one of those countries. Cuba and Czechoslovakia also developed a joint operations in Chile. Danislav L. Hatsky, a Czechoslovak intelligence agent, was in Chile officially under an economic cover. His instructions were to develop in concert with the Cuban production and distribution networks in Chile first, and then to expand the network into Argentina and Brazil. When Lahatsky returned to Czechoslovakia in 67, he was awarded the Order of Red Star for his successful work in building the drug network in Chile. So they took over the whole all of South America. One of Cuba's early contributions to the drug operation in Chile, identified in a DEA intelligence report, was the recruitment of Marxist Senator Salvador Allende, who would later become president. Allende was also present at the Tricontinental Conference. He proposed creation of OLAS, O-L-A-S, the Latin American Solidarity Organization, as a united front advocating armed revolution, and was elected its first leader. During Allende's presidency, drug trafficking flourished. In 1973, U.S. authorities seized $309 million worth of cocaine produced in Chilean laboratories. In Argentina, the Czechoslovak drug operation was established by one of Czechoslovakia's most successful agents, Oldřich Limbursky, who was functioning in Argentina as a representative of a Czechoslovak export company. He built the drug network in Argentina and then expanded it into Brazil. In short, the Cubans were highly effective in establishing operations throughout Latin America. Both Fidel and Raul Castro were enthusiastic and pushed hard to have drug activities expanded faster than the Soviets deemed prudent. Fidel Castro's first visit to Czechoslovakia was particularly noteworthy in this respect. His visit coincided with an extended visit to Moscow following the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was annoyed, to say the least, and spent roughly 10 days complaining to top Soviet leaders about their general lack of consultation with him. Then he went on to Czechoslovakia. The conversations with Fidel were most difficult, Sagina explains. Fidel thought he could destroy capitalism overnight. He wanted to exploit crime for revolution and use knowledge of people already corrupted by drugs, which was flowing in from the Cuban infiltration operation, to help speed the sale of drugs. The drugs will help us, Sagina recalls Castro emphasizing, in our defense in obtaining money and in liquidating capitalism. Fidel was absolutely adamant. You know, I think Fidel Castro is worth $675 million today, and his people are eating still life paintings. This episode, in fact, was one reason why the Soviets regarded him as an anarchist more than as a communist. The Czechoslovak officials argued long and hard to convince Fidel they needed to prepare for the next 20 years, not just for tomorrow. So they're in it for the long haul, the destruction of the United States. And you're trying to live here in the short haul. It is not possible, they stressed, to change the old generation. It is not possible, they stressed, to change the old generation. We can corrupt them and exploit them through crime to obtain information and to influence decisions. But the focus for change has to be the younger generation. These were the people that we needed to work on to change the military, to retard scientific development, and to influence government leadership. This is why American youth had been selected as a primary target for the drug offensive. I think if you went into any high school and asked a student, did you know your picture is on the wall in Czechoslovakia as a target? He would laugh at you. To communicate the Soviet drugs strategy more decisively and clearly to Fidel, Czechoslovak officials organized a detailed briefing on Khrushchev's strategy of peaceful coexistence, which was designed, as Khrushchev had explained to high-level Czech officials in 1954, not to befriend the Americans, but lead them to the grave more quickly. The whole operation, and I got to tell you, there are people out there that want the same objective. The whole operation was laid out so that Fidel would understand how the use of drugs was integrated into the overall strategy and therefore why it was not possible simply to isolate drugs and treat drug trafficking as an independent operation. Drug trafficking had been designed as an integral part of a coordinated strategy, and it was essential that Fidel understood the importance of this long-range systematic destruction of capitalism. In addition to production and trafficking, Cuba was also involved in research and development of new drugs. In the fall of 1963, Raul Castro's deputy went to Czechoslovakia for assistance in obtaining special equipment for producing drugs in Colombia and for manufacturing synthetic drugs as part of an experimental program in Cuba. The actual equipment was picked up by Raul Castro in April 1964 when he stopped over in Prague after a visit to Moscow. Subsequently, the Czech Chief of Health Administration of the Rear Services, Colonel General Miroslav Hamela, accompanied by two subordinates and two technicians, flew to Cuba to sign an agreement on medical cooperation, which was a cover for drug research. How's that? Oh, yeah, come on down to the hospitals. We got the best hospital system. To teach the Cubans how to operate the equipment and to instruct Castro to begin local production of drugs in the Dominican Republic. This was part of the Soviet decision to produce drugs locally whenever possible, rather than ship them in from the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. Cubans were to be used as operators so as to keep the Soviets clean. Soviets never get their hands dirty. They killed a lot of Americans in Korea. They killed a lot of Americans in Vietnam with the help of politicians, especially the ones that said SAM missile sites were off limits and you couldn't bomb Hanoi. Those are the ones who killed most of those guys on that wall. May they burn in hell for it. Following these various measures to penetrate existing drug organizations and then to set up Cuban operations throughout Latin America, the Soviets ordered the formation of still another set of backup production and distribution networks all over the region. This one organized directly by selected East European intelligence services. Czechoslovakia's first target was Colombia. Poor Colombia. They get a bad rap, man. To kickstart the new operation, the Soviets recommended that the Czechs should recruit one of the key individuals from Cuba's drug network in Colombia, a retired Colombian military officer who went by the name of Kovacs. The top secret code name for the Czech operation in Colombia was Pyramid, and it was selected to mislead people into associating the new initiative with the Middle East. The Czech officer in charge of this operation was the first deputy at the Ministry of Interior. Shortly afterwards, he became the Ministry of Interior. Amazing though it may be, though it may seem, some in the West do not appreciate that in the overt communist system, the Minister of Interior is not the person in charge of natural resources or parks, which is what Westerners usually associate with the title. Rather, the Minister of Interior is in charge of interior security, that is, civilian intelligence and the secret police. Kovacs traveled to Czechoslovakia in 1964 with a plan for the new operation to be approved by Czech intelligence. To cover his trip, he went to Mexico, where he was provided with a forged passport at the Czech embassy. From Mexico, he flew to Vienna, where he was provided with the Czech passport to use on the third leg of his journey. The final plan that he brought with him for the new activities in Colombia was first taken to the Soviet Union for approval. Then the plan, modified to incorporate last-minute Soviet suggestions, was presented to the Czech Defense Council, and the plan set forth guidelines and planning estimates, the most important of which were: 1. With help in obtaining the necessary equipment, production of cocaine would begin within 6 months. 2. the distribution network would be in operation in less than 6 months. Three, initial distribution would be into the United States and Canada and later extended to Europe. And four, distribution would be kept out of the local market. At the presentation of the Joint Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Interior plan, the Minister of Defense explained that 12 people had already been recruited for the operation and that 8 of them had been cleared in two ways. First, by the Communist Party of Colombia, and second, by the longtime Czech intelligence agent, who was then a high official with Colombia's Internal Security Ministry. The plan was unanimously approved by the Czech Defense Council. And here we are singing The Farmer and the Dell and The Cheese Stands Alone. Because the most effective, and I can't stand it when any politician talks about our allies. We have no allies. We absolutely have no allies. We are the cheese who stands alone. Because the most effective Cuban drug operation was developing in Mexico, the Soviets now directed the Czechs to infiltrate and gain control of this operation. And the Czech top secret code for this operation was called Rhine, like the river in Germany, was selected to mislead people into associating it with Europe. The Czechoslovak agent who was responsible for this initiative, Major Jidrak Sternad, had been operating in Mexico under cover of an export company. His Z's control officer was Colonel Borsky. The Cubans had been especially effective in recruiting Mexicans to establish production and distribution networks and in using the associated corruption information for blackmailing Mexican officials. That's the bad part, man. Once you go dirty, you can't get clean. Recognizing the strategic location, the Soviets were especially impressed, and one of the main reasons for directing Czech intelligence to infiltrate the Cuban operation was to learn the secrets of their success in Mexico. Recognizing the strategic location of Mexico, the Soviets further directed the establishment of a second Czechoslovak operation in Mexico, which was designed to complement the Rhine initiative, and this code name was the second operation was Full Moon. This drug campaign had two purposes. The first was to develop an extensive network for smuggling drugs into the U.S. So if the Soviets ever want to bring a suitcase nuke in, they can come right up to the routes that they already created. Of course, it won't be the Soviets that get the blame for it. They'll probably blame it on Sarah Palin. The first was to develop an extensive network for smuggling drugs into the U.S. The second was to train intelligence agents who would then be inserted into the United States and Canada with instructions to penetrate drug distribution networks. Through their contacts into supply networks in Mexico, they were to access the supply network and gradually take control of the drug business in the United States and Canada. I'm going to break up for a tune, catch my breath. When I come back, we'll continue Red Cocaine, Building the Latin American Drug Network. Hang in there.
Permit me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kick. I dwell in a dark dominion away down by the river Styx. The devil has sent me here because I'm full of wicked tricks. And I'm such a popular fellow among all you lunatics. I teach a course in ruination from the devil's text. To fools who can't withstand temptation, step right up your neck. I hail from a hollow hellhole down along the river Styx. Allow me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kicks. When an old wolf starts prowling out among the young lambs howling, don't you know he's looking for kicks? When a young cat, full of fly tricks, spends his evenings chasing fly chicks, 10 to 1 he's looking for kicks. Kicks is always in demand, cause kicks is full of fun and laughter. Lots of folks get out of hand because it's only kicks they're after. Shady lady and her lover operating undercover. She knows sin and virtue don't mix. Her mama raised her prim and proper, but now wild hawk bills couldn't stop us when she's on a manhunt for kicks.
Okay, I'm back. I cut the tune short. You got the message? Kicks. Don't we all want kicks? This was a push-pull drug operation. The name Full Moon referred to the time when Soviet bloc agents would be in control of most major groups in the United States and Canada. Mexico, it should be noted, has also been an important country in the Chinese drug offensive. With both Soviets, initially through the Cubans, and Chinese having targeted Mexico, it comes as no surprise that Mexico is one of the primary drug trafficking routes into the United States for heroin, cocaine, and marijuana, one of which the communists want to legalize under George Soros, and then they will follow up with the other two shortly thereafter. And you can watch your kids' brains get fried. And, it's another way to they don't have to pay off on Social Security because the kids will be dead by the time they're 40. For identical reasons, Canada is another primary drug trafficking route into the United States. Man, we're barrage. You know why we're barrage? Because we got the cash. Once the cash is gone, the country won't be worth a plug nickel. Czechoslovak intelligence was also involved in the Cuban operation in Panama under the code name Pablo. A Cuban operation was set up, too, in El Salvador. At a meeting of the financing of the Communist Party of El Salvador, yes, you know, all of these guys, you think they're out slinging AK-47s for the poor people. They're slinging them for the cash. Sagina remembers that the Soviets directed the Cubans to provide the financing for that party out of their profits from the El Salvador drug operation. The separate Soviet operation intended for the benefit of those who regularly seek the warm sands and seas of the Caribbean islands was directly targeted to take advantage of the booming Caribbean tourist trade. The second secretary of the French Communist Party, a longtime KGB agent, together with the first secretary of the Communist Party of Guadeloupe, conceived the idea of distributing drugs to Caribbean tourists. Their objectives were to raise money out of the tourist trade and obtain blackmail information on vacationing Americans and other members of the bourgeoisie. You can see blackmail is a big tactic among these people. They helped establish the operation and provided recommendations on whom to recruit to run it. The operation was turned over to two Czechoslovak intelligence officers, one from military intelligence and one from the Ministry of Interior. Both officials had been born in France and spoke fluent French. Guadeloupe was the center of the operation, which served Martinique and the other islands. The monies earned in the late 60s from this initiative proved adequate to finance all communist intelligence operations in Guadeloupe, Martinique, Suriname, Haiti, and most of France. In the early 1960s, the Soviets were rapidly building organizations throughout North, Central, and South America and the Caribbean. Other Soviet satellites directly involved as Soviet surrogates, in addition to Czechoslovakia and Cuba, were Hungary, East Germany, Bulgaria, and Poland. Understandingly, most of Sagina's knowledge was of the Czechoslovak dimension of the drug strategy. The other East European satellites identified above are not dealt with in detail in this analysis, but they were all deeply involved in the Soviet drug offensive. Romania and Albania were not part of the formal Soviet directed offensive because the Soviets did not trust their security. Albania had asked to participate, emphasizing its strong intelligence network in the Balkans and the Middle East. But rather than bring Albania into the operation, The Soviets decided to provide Albania with the money to purchase the necessary equipment so that Albania could proceed as an independent drug promoter. Countries where Sagina had direct knowledge of organizations, which had been established by the mid-1960s, included Canada, Mexico, Panama, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, Peru, Guadalupe, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and quite naturally, the United States. To this list should be added countries where organized crime operations that were critical to the drug trafficking network were being developed. One example was Venezuela, which the Soviets decided in 1961 to use as a center for mafia organization operations and money laundering in the Western Hemisphere. The drugs initially chosen for distribution were opium, heroin, morphine, marijuana, and synthetics such as LSD, while cocaine was not prominent at the time. By 1961, the Soviets, in analyzing the drug scene, had concluded that cocaine was, to borrow one of their favorite phrases, the wave of the future. The revelation to Sagina came during a meeting in Moscow, which had been convened to discuss, coordinate, deceptive planning. In attendance from Czechoslovakia was the head of the military section of the Administrative Organs Department. I got 38 seconds left. The deputy chief of the main political administration, all the big boys were there. It was at this meeting that Shevchenko introduced the term pink epidemic in discussing the future. He stressed the potential of cocaine. It was highly preferable to heroin because it was much easier to produce and because they believed that many more people could be reached with cocaine than with heroin. The Soviets were so impressed with cocaine's potential, in fact, that they spoke in terms of it becoming an epidemic, a white epidemic, to serve and extend the epidemic. Shevchenko explained a separate production and distribution base was to be built, commencing immediately. Okay, we are now off the air. So I will conclude, and when we do Chapter 4, which is Khrushchev Instructs the Satellites, I'll talk to you. Have a nice night. Say a little prayer for those 9 who were butchered by a liberal in Tucson. God bless America.